Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Lauren Volkelbaum.
And today we're going to talk about some unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs, also known as
drones.
So drones have been in the news a lot for multiple reasons. Some of them are fun reasons and some of them are not so fun reasons.
Right. They are a really interesting development in robotics that has a lot of very positive applications and unfortunately a lot of negative ones as well.
Right. So we're going to cover kind of the whole spectrum, right? We're going to look at everything from the silly and sublime to the
Pretty serious
and scary, really.
Yeah.
And also talk about why is there a debate about drones.
But so to start off, Jonathan, what exactly is a UAV?
Okay, so unmanned aerial vehicle. You can essentially say that this is any sort of flying device that doesn't carry a passenger in it that is used for some other purpose. Usually we go one step beyond what would be a typical RC airplane or RC helicopter. You wouldn't really call that a drone because there's not really anything on there other than the fact that this is something for you to pilot around and have fun with.
So like a remote control air shark, maybe not a drone.
Yeah, probably not a drone. But if you were to put, say, a camera in that remote controlled air shark and you could actually spy on people, that would be a air shark drone. Probably not the most subtle of unmanned drones that you've ever seen. But maybe you were to create something like a camera on it and also it'd have some sort of fabric display, which is a possibility. Let's say you have a fabric display and then on the underside, it can actually show you pictures. That would be like a crazy kind of art experiment that I would expect to see at Burning Man.
Or DragonCon.
DragonCon.
I really want that now, actually.
Yes.
But anyway.
Totally something that could be a possibility. And so when we're talking about drones, we're usually talking about something that does something on top of just flying around. Now, that might mean that it's got some cameras and sensors on it that allow it to do some things like navigate through spaces or give you a look at a particular area. Maybe it doesn't have those sensors. Maybe it just carries stuff. And we'll talk about some of the crazy delivery drones that have popped up, sometimes literally, across the globe. But usually these are controlled remotely by a pilot using some sort of interface that connects via radio signal to the vehicle's navigation and control systems. Or the vehicles themselves are autonomous, meaning that they can use their own sensors.
Pre-programmed.
Yeah, exactly. You have to program what it's going to do ahead of time. It's not like they have artificial intelligence and can, you know, it's not RoboCop on wings, you know?
I suppose it could hypothetically be.
One day we mm-hmm. might get there. But right now we're talking about devices that you give it a pre-programmed set of parameters. Perhaps it's to fly to a specific coordinate and then fly back. And it's using things like the GPS sensor to navigate to where it needs to go. But otherwise, once you've set it in motion, it takes control of itself. I think most drones tend to be under human control, although we have drastically increased that capability. It used to be that it was all line of sight. In other words, the controller had to be able to see the drone in order to maintain control. That's not the case now, but we'll get into that.
Increases in miniaturization and GPS technology has really pushed that field forward.
Certainly, yeah. Satellite communications has made it possible for us to have ridiculous kinds of control over unmanned aerial vehicles. Mm-hmm. So they can often stay in the air for longer than a day, particularly when we start talking about some of the ones that are used in scientific research mm-hmm. and military applications.
They can go for up to I've heard up to 48 hours and without refueling in some cases.
Yeah, exactly. So you can have 48 hours of consistent flight time. And now, obviously, if you're talking about a manned control situation, you then are also talking about having shifts of pilots.
Switching off teams of pilots, right?
Right. And
there's usually for this kind of thing, two pilots, one to actually do the controlling, assuming that it's not being autonomously controlled.
Right.
And a second watching the sensory readouts.
Exactly.
And helping the pilot, therefore.
Right. And then some cases you're talking about even larger teams, but we'll talk about some of the more complex ones in a bit. So they also can vary pretty widely in size and sophistication. So a typical tiny little drone, you might think of like the Parrot drone, which is a quadrocopter drone. It's the kind that has the rotors on the four corners.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives it a very stable flight path. And you can even do some crazy tricks. Well, you can do crazy trips too if you wanted to, but crazy tricks, letting it do things like barrel rolls, although it's more like a very quick flip because obviously you lose stabilization once those blades go vertical as opposed to horizontal. And then you can control that with an iPhone. So
right.
You can actually use a smartphone to control a Parrot drone. I was talking earlier today about how I had a really crazy schedule today. So today, Jonathan's schedule included a phone call with FEMA, a talk about electronics in the FAA, which was an episode that we recorded earlier today, although when it publishes, is a mystery. And then also talking about drones. And so a friend of mine said, oh, so is this all in preparation for talking about how FEMA could control a drone with an iPhone, because the Apple event was also the day that we're recording this. I said, you know, you're making a joke, but that's totally possible. Because the Parrot drone allows you to control it with an iPhone.
Absolutely. And these are small, you know, commercial devices. You can go out and buy something like this.
Yeah, you can actually buy one right now. And I remember the first time I saw one at CES several years ago, maybe 2010 or maybe even earlier. And I was really impressed. And it included a little camera on the device itself, so it could allow you to look around, and you were able to play games with other people who had Parrot drones and do kind of a virtual shoot 'em up type thing that would be reflected with your actual drone's real world location. So it's kind of neat stuff. But if you want to talk about the other end of the spectrum, now that's on the simple side, right? That's a very small portable device that the average person can use, and you're using a very simple interface to control it. The other end of that spectrum is drones that are the size of an actual, like, manned aircraft.
Like a small business jet or so, I think, is the size that Reapers are, which I think are the largest military drone in
Reaper
use
and
right
Predators
now.
Are both
right.
Pretty big. Yeah. Yeah. Because Predator, if you see a picture of a Predator drone, you might think, what's the size of that? Is that, like, maybe, you know, half the size of a car? No, those are much bigger than cars.
Yeah.
But they from casual glance, if you were near one, you might think, well, that's an interesting jet. Where's the cockpit? Because I don't see where the person would look out.
Because it looks blank.
Yeah. But it's, in fact, a drone. And so you end up flying it using all the different sensors and cameras that are on it as the guidance.
Although for aerodynamic purposes, it's still shaped more or less the way that a passenger airplane would be.
Right. I mean, and that just makes sense for pure physics, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like, you know, theoretically we could have it shaped anything that would fly, but why would you change it up so much if that's the most efficient shape?
I kind of want them to paint, just go ahead and paint like a Cylon toaster face on the end.
Have
of
like
them.
A little LED that goes back and forth and it just constantly chants by your command. That's from the 1978 Superior version of Battlestar Galactica.
We're really going to have a geek fight about that someday, Jonathan. Anyway.
That's fair. There will be a reckoning. So with those kind of military style drones are the ones that scientific endeavors are using. These large, large drones. Those are the ones that need multiple people to really control it. And also they usually have a link up where you can control it from quite a far way away, but we'll get into that a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's some rules about drones though, right?
Yes. Some countries, China, for example, and this will become important in a moment, it's basically legal to operate commercial drones anywhere that you want as long as you get local authorization. Here in the U.S., drones are authorized in some military airspace and to patrol our borders. Also, there's some 300 public agencies that can use them at low altitudes away from airports.
Right. It's essentially the same sort of rules that that guide RC flight vehicles,
right,
like anything
sure.
like a remote control plane or remote controlled helicopter. There are specific rules that are dictated by the U.S. government, and most of them are the same as for the drones.
Sure, sure. And now the FAA, the Federal
Aviation
Administration. Thank you. I always want to say aeronautics, and that's not quite the right word. Is working on new regulations right now. They're supposed to come out in 2015, and at that point, we're probably going to see a lot more commercial and private drones flying around.
Yeah, it's going to be one of those things where there may be some more specific rules to guide this sort of thing. This is, again, another one of those examples of how technology evolves faster than the legal system.
The legislature,
can. Yeah.
Sure.
Because, I mean, I don't know if you've ever noticed, but the government does not move at the speed of light.
Certainly not by Moore's Law, no.
No. So we see these developments happen faster than the way agencies can legislate them. But that is coming. The 2015 will be interesting to see exactly how the FAA handles that and how, you know, is it going to be really restricted? Is it going to open things up? Will there be specific agencies that people who operate drones will have to report to? We don't know.
Yeah.
We have to wait.
It's part of a larger, like, $63.4 billion initiative for the FAA to update traffic control systems and expand airspace. So.
Yeah, it's important stuff. So let's talk about some uses, fun uses, of some drones, like scientific research.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of organizations out there that are using drones in some way or another to conduct scientific research. And that includes NASA and NOAA. Those organizations are both using drones to study inhospitable environments here on Earth.
Right. You know, lots of places that it would either be overly expensive or difficult or dangerous to get humans out to take a look at.
Right, yeah. If we can get an unmanned aerial vehicle to fly by, say, a giant crater that's remote and difficult to access otherwise.
Or in a volcano or
right.
at an oil spill or...
Exactly, yeah. So here are some of the examples, and we've mentioned a couple of them. Oil spills, volcanic ash, that kind of stuff, looking at these sort of things. That can be hazardous. But also drones to explore repositories of ice in Greenland, Antarctica, and Alaska. In other words, trying to get a real look at what how these giant areas of ice are doing, because the melt-off is happening pretty quickly, but it's hard to get a good look at it because these are pretty remote areas. UAVs can give us a much closer look at that. NASA's using them to study hurricanes. So we're looking at the way hurricanes develop and sort of the paths they take, and also how storms can change when they start to encounter different types of land masses.
This hurricane season in particular, NASA is using a lot of drones to just watch the way storms are developing and send information back.
Yeah, they're using what are called Global Hawk drones, which are the same type of drones that are used in some military surveillance operations. Global Hawk is not the most prevalent of the drones that the military uses, but it's sort of one of the precursors to what we tend to use today. We've also seen agencies use these drones to study wildfires and to get an idea of where the wildfire is spreading. Again, obviously a very dangerous situation to send people into. And, you know, the worst case scenario with a drone in this kind of situation is that you lose an expensive piece of equipment. But the worst case scenario in other situations is that you lose a human life.
Right.
So that's obviously one of those reasons why it's very attractive for scientific study.
Also, as a bonus, these things can fly lower, slower, and more quietly than a typical manned aircraft.
Right. So you can get a longer look at things. And perhaps if you're using it even to study things like wildlife, it's not likely to disturb
the environment.
Yes.
Right.
And these research vehicles can vary just like the UAVs we talked about at the top of the show. And Lauren, I think you found an interesting UAV that's being used in scientific research, something that's actually using solar power.
Right. There's something called a Pathfinder that was built in the 1990s for civilian purposes, like collecting data on weather and the climate. It's reached a record of height for solar powered aircraft, which is
67,350 feet.
Yeah, which is something like 20 kilometers.
Wow, 20 kilometers. That is pretty incredible elevation for an unmanned vehicle.
Right. And, you know, not too shabby. And that kind of data is important.
Yep. So other uses for drones include things like historic research. I came across an article that was interesting. It was talking about Peruvian archaeologists who were using drones to explore ancient ruins without disturbing the area with actual vehicle or foot traffic.
So, oh, wow.
They didn't want to disturb an area that had a lot of cultural and historical significance. Also, they want to use drones as a way of monitoring a site. So not just mapping a site, which has turned out to be incredibly useful. In fact, I read one archaeologist report that said that they were able to do in a few days the same sort of work that normally would take them years to map out a site.
Wow.
But they also want to use it in order to monitor a site and keep people from taking advantage of it. There are examples of people who have squatted on land that's directly adjacent to historic sites, either as a means of trying to monetize that or just because they figure that by being close to something like that, they are less likely to be displaced. So it's kind of it's this idea of trying to protect the area before people try and leverage that in some other way.
Sure. You also had a note about using this for pest control?
Yeah, Florida's looking at using drones for pest control. Now, they're not actually talking about arming drones with some sort of pesticide and then blasting it at
some
bugs.
Kind of laser mosquito zapper or something like that. No,
they're outfitting all the drones with these two giant robot arms that come together in a slapping motion, and then they're just going to squish them one by one. Actually, that's not true. No, it's Florida's looking at using drones in a way of controlling the mosquito population. Now, mosquitoes obviously can carry lots of different diseases that can be very harmful to animals and people.
And they mostly breed in very shallow pools of water.
Yeah, still shallow pools of water. That's where you get the mosquitoes breeding. You get all the mosquito larvae. And, I don't know if you're familiar with Florida, having lived there for so long. But,
yeah, only 14 years, so
there's
a little bit.
There's like a little puddle called the Everglades that's out there, where it's a large area, right? We're talking like lots and lots of square miles, or kilometers if you prefer, that could potentially have this kind of shallow water where mosquitoes could breed. Now, traditionally, what would happen is Florida would send out people to go and cover this ground and look for places that would be mosquito breeding grounds and then treat those areas so that they could control the mosquito population somewhat. But that's time consuming and expensive, and it's hard. It's hard to send people out and really, you know,
cover all that ground because it really is a great deal of ground. There's alligators
and tourists. Sometimes crocodiles if you get far enough toward the coast. Anyway, the point being that there are many things that could potentially cause someone harm or just be difficult to navigate around, not to mention things like boa constrictors and anacondas.
But more importantly, drones can be used to deliver cakes.
Okay, yes. All right. So we're going beyond pest control here. We're going into using drones to deliver things, including possibly cake, although that may or may not also be a lie. No, drone delivery is something that has popped up a few places, and it's mostly, I would argue, a kind of a publicity stunt.
It's a marketing thing.
Yeah,
it's not
meant as actual, like, here's
a serious service, because it is so much more expensive and
time-consuming, and it's still very work-intensive, because you still have to have someone navigating the drones, and in most of these cases, the drones are remote-controlled, so there's actually...
So you have to have a car or a person following the drone.
Right. Where you could just have that person deliver whatever it is, but that's not nearly as cool as having this rotocopter thing drop from the sky and deliver your pizza.
Yeah.
And by the way, pizza is one of the things. In fact, Domino's Pizza, the Domicopter.
Domicopter. This was in the UK, right?
Yeah, it was in the UK. It was a joint effort between AeroSight, which was the company that built the drone, a company called Big Communications, and another company called Tea Plus Biscuits. Tea and biscuits.
That's cute.
It is cute. And very, very British. And so this was a sort of a publicity stunt where they showed a quadcopter, very similar to something like the Parrot drone that you could look up online. It was a quadcopter that could carry a bag that would contain pizzas, a heat bag. You know, it's one of those that is lined with a reflective material on the inside to try and keep as much heat in as possible. And I saw a video where they loaded one up with two pizzas and then flew it over some fields into a different like neighborhood and landed it near a guy who pulled his pizzas out, and then it flew off again. Very clever, but again, mostly just a marketing kind of stunt here. It's not something, you're not going to get robot delivery of pizzas, because like you were saying, Lauren, you had to have a human pilot who had to have a line of sight on this to make sure that they were not going to pilot into a tree or drop the pizza in the wrong place. I mean, nothing is more irritating, I think you'll agree, than when you order pizza and you find out that, you know, my
pizza drone has delivered to the next house over.
Right. Yeah. Like all those people who listen to Fish all night long, ate all your pizza. You know what I'm talking about, Lauren. Anyway, so.
All the time with those pizza drones.
Yeah.
Also in Shanghai, China, a company called InCake was delivering cakes in a very similar way.
Yeah. Another delivery company in China called SF Express was using drones to deliver packages. The packages could weigh up to 6.6 pounds or just under 3 kilograms. And the drones themselves could fly at an elevation of 330 feet or just over 100 meters, which is pretty high for one of those little quadcopters.
Supposedly that InCake company got shut down, or the drone delivery system anyway got shut down by Shanghai police when they got worried calls in from the populace saying, like, I am in danger from this cake drone.
There are aliens.
Save me.
There
save
aliens,
me from this cake drone.
Aliens flying over the city and they're dropping confectionery on us.
They were like $300 cakes. I'm a little bit obsessed with this.
Yeah, I'd eat some flying cake. So in Philadelphia, there was a dry cleaner, the Manayunk cleaners, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, but any kind of Native American names from the Northeast are completely beyond my ability to pronounce. But anyway, this was a dry cleaners that used a drone to deliver dry cleaned, clothing to customers. But that one required two operators. It required someone who was holding the controller and also a spotter.
Because there was no
camera on it.
Right. Most of these rigs have included cameras.
Right. Yeah.
But,
like the Domino's one had a camera aboard
right.
it. So if you watch the video, you can actually see it from the drone's point of view as it flies across the English countryside, delivering pizza by flight.
By robot.
There's also the taco copter, which I really hope this becomes a thing, because if I could get my tacos delivered by robot, I don't think I'd ever leave the house. It's a San Francisco area, Bay Area, invite only app where you can order tacos and have them delivered via drone. Although it's more or less just a concept right now. It's not really a service. And again, this is one of those things where they are talking about waiting for the FAA's regulations to really, you know, it doesn't make sense to pour a lot of money into a business that might not be able to operate depending upon what the FAA's regulations are.
Right, sure. That goes along with your next note, which is for a burrito bomber.
Yes, Darwin Aerospace's burrito bomber. It's a drone that drops burritos on you, but the burritos also have little parachutes.
Little parachutes.
Yeah, so you get parachute-dropped burritos. I would welcome a delivery of burritos by a parachute over my place. I do not welcome people just pelting my place with burritos. I want to be clear about this. I want to go home and find a bunch of burritos splatted against my house.
You guys, I have to admit, I think that that would be hilarious.
Yeah. What's your address, Lauren? So, these are some of those kind of gimmicky, clever things that we're seeing, but I don't think that it's necessarily going to become a real delivery service anytime soon beyond just the curiosity.
Certainly not until here in the U.S., the FAA passes those new regulations.
Right. The China one I can almost understand because at least the SF Express one was all about delivering in a city in China that was known for its massive traffic congestion.
Right. It's a city of about 8 million, I think, that was on a relatively small territory. And it was in the testing phases as of the last time that I read an article about it.
Yeah.
But it seemed like it was operating within parameters as of yet.
Yeah.
So since it is legal in China, basically.
Yeah. In that case, I can kind of see it happening in the sense that, well, there are some use case scenarios where it would actually be more efficient to have someone who perhaps is on like a fairly tall building and can navigate something that way. But even then, it's, you know, It's a little weird. So that kind of covers the civilian and corporate uses of drones, as well as the research institute uses of drones. But there's another use that we need to cover, and that, of course, is military. But that's a huge, huge topic. So before we get into that, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsor. All right. So here's the part of our conversation where we really do get pretty serious and talk about a controversial use of drones, and there are a couple of different ways that the military uses them, and one is certainly far more controversial than the other. But first, let's look at sort of the history of unmanned aerial vehicles in the military.
Because it goes back quite a long way.
Yeah. In fact, the first one is arguably, you can argue this is the first use of UAVs in military. The first one actually predates powered manned flight. And that would be on August 22nd, 1849. And I know what you're all thinking. Like, how could there be a drone in 1849? No, it wasn't so much a drone as it was this concept of, I want to be able to attack a certain target, and I want to do it in a way that's going to minimize risk to my resources. How do I do that? Well, the Austrians figured, during the First Italian War of Independence, which was a war that was fought between the Kingdom of Sardinia and the Austrian Empire for control of Italy,
They
figured, well, we want to attack Venice, but we don't want to risk our own resources. We're going to use 200 balloons, and each balloon is going to carry a bomb, and those bombs will have some method of detonation. I have read different reports, nothing that was completely confirmed, but one was that there was actually a wire that would come back that they would apply an electric charge to, and that would detonate the bombs. Others said it was just a fuse. But at any rate, the balloons were meant to float over toward Venice and then detonate there. From what I understand, it was not a very successful attack. I think only a handful of balloons actually made it toward Venice, but a shift in the wind meant that some of them just started floating right back toward the Austrian lines, which is not what you want to see when you're launching an attack. Of course, if they had complete control of when those bombs detonated, then that would just mean it would be a failed attack as opposed to a catastrophe.
To a danger,
yeah.
Right. During the American Civil War, a patent was filed for a similar time delay fuse mechanism balloon-based bomber that I don't think ever went into use because they couldn't ever quite figure out how to make that fuse
work properly,
operate in a non-hazardous way.
Right, where you're not just as likely to blow up yourself as you are your target.
Sure. In the 1880s, cameras were used on kites during the Spanish-American War for reconnaissance purposes.
Right. The British Royal Navy began to experiment with radio-controlled Queen Bee.
This was a drone, a radio-controlled drone for mostly for target practice.
Yep. Okay.
But it could fly like 100 miles per hour, which I feel like is a pretty impressive drone capacity for the time.
Mm-hmm.
During World War II, the Nazis developed what was called the Revenge Weapon 1, or V-1 more commonly, which was an unmanned bomber that was responsible for over 900 British civilian deaths.
Mm. And that was when, wait, what? Bomb-wielding bats? Am I reading this note right?
So Franklin D. Roosevelt approved research into releasing bomb-wielding bats from airplanes. And ideally, with the way this would work would be that the bats would seek shelter in buildings, chew through the string, separating themselves from the devices, and then the device would detonate, you know, blowing up the enemy's buildings. In the only test that ever happened that I've heard about, a bunch of hibernating bomb-laden bats were dropped to their deaths from an airplane.
So the bats were asleep and then just were dropped and then they splatted. Wow. Well, we salute you, splatted bats. So in the 60s and 70s, the U.S. used the AQM-34 Ryan Firebees and Lightning Bugs. So what, these are reconnaissance robots?
Yeah. They were controlled from a host plane. Those Lightning Bugs were joystick controlled, actually. Mm. And those were used for reconnaissance in China and Vietnam.
They had a lot of problems with these reconnaissance vehicles, particularly in harsh weather conditions. And then that was one of the things that would really spur the military to try and develop more robust unmanned aerial vehicles. It also was one of the things that critics would point out as saying, this is kind of a fool's errand. Like, we're spending a lot of money developing and building these things, but if they crash just as frequently as they come back, and it's not because of enemy encounters, it's just because of the weather, then there have to be better use for our resources. So, in fact, you could argue that drone technology isn't as far along as it could be because of things like this.
Sure. Israel, in fact, was the first country to develop very modern, advanced drones. In the 70s and 80s, they developed gliders along the same concept as the quadricopters and octocopters that we have these days, called the Scout and the Pioneer. The Scout had live video and like 360-degree
views. So they could see an entire, like, all the way around the actual vehicle itself.
Right. And the Pioneers the U.S. acquired from Israel for use in the Gulf War.
Gotcha. So now, one of the main uses the military has for these drones is for surveillance and reconnaissance. And in those cases, you don't have to necessarily have weapons aboard the drones.
Oh, absolutely not. And I think that the development of most of these in the U.S., anyway, has been for reconnaissance purposes. Mm. And that weaponizing them has been a secondary step taken afterwards.
Right. And I think when it comes to the controversy, while reconnaissance and surveillance, of course, has its own set of issues.
Sure.
I would argue that I think most people, when they hear about drones, are specifically thinking of the weaponized versions. We'll talk about those in a minute. And obviously those have their own set of really big issues that I think merit debate, in fact. And I think all of it merits debate, but I think those in particular are ones that we really got to take a very close look at and ask some very tough questions and maybe finally get some answers, because that's part of the problem.
Would be good too. But so these drones these days, thanks to satellite uplinks, have, you know, you can get live video of a place that would be dangerous to send manned forces into.
Right. And not only that, but you can have real-time control of a drone by someone who is nowhere near that actual zone. So, for example, if you need to run a drone through a war zone so that you can get real-time look at what the conditions are on the ground, you can send one of these drones out, and the pilot may be on the other side of the world. In fact, in the United States, there's a desert in Nevada where you can find some of the trailers that the U.S. Air Force uses, and the CIA also has its own drone program. Where the pilots are nowhere near where the actual drone is, which means that the risk to pilot life is completely negated. You don't have to worry about the pilot being put in danger, even if the drone flies into a truly hot spot of dangerous activity.
And you can hypothetically save military lives out in those areas by, you know, getting information about what's out there,
right,
you know, what the terrain is like,
what they can expect
to
encounter.
Sure. Are there.
Yeah. So it's, you know, really meant to maximize data while minimizing risk to human life. And these are less expensive than military aircraft or satellites. So it's considered to be a better, better investment in that sense as well. So not only are you minimizing the risk to human life, but it's not as expensive as something like a U-2 spy plane or a spy satellite.
Absolutely.
Now, there's the weaponized version, which is the truly problematic one. Not that surveillance, again, is, we can't give it a free pass, but the weaponized ones are the ones that have really come under scrutiny recently. These are battle drones. So they're armed for combat. They actually carry weapons, usually in the form of either missiles or bombs or some combination thereof.
And usually more lightweight missiles or bombs than you would find on manned aircraft.
Yeah.
However.
Yeah, like Hellfire missiles. I mean, these are still weapons designed to
absolutely.
Do damage.
And, absolutely.
The very first use of armed drones were in the Balkans War. The Predator drone is an example of a U.S. military unmanned aerial vehicle capable of firing weapons. So it's not the only one. The U.K. has the Reaper drone, which also can be weaponized.
And we do use Reapers in the U.S. as
yep.
well.
Mm-hmm.
The Predator was originally meant for surveillance and
right.
was later added.
Yeah, in fact, the first thing that was added to it were targeting lasers, and that was before it even had weapons on the Predator. It
right.
was just sort of a next step in the evolution of the Predator from surveillance drone to battle drone. And keep in mind that the military and the CIA both use these different variations. It's not that all drones are weaponized. That's not the case. Some of them are and some of them aren't.
Right.
It all depends upon the parameters of the mission and what it is you are trying to actually achieve. So usually the way this works is that you've got three operators who are controlling the drone. One of them is controlling the flight systems. Another one, like you said, Lauren, is monitoring those cameras and sensors. The third acts as a communications officer between the flight crew and the ground operations that are closer to the actual war zone. So that's to keep that line of communication open so that if you notice something with the drone where it's going to affect operations on the ground, you can get that information to the people who need it immediately, and they're not going to be surprised by it. So perhaps the best known battle drone, I guess, would be at least in the United States, is the Predator. You've probably seen pictures of it. It's pretty spooky looking. And it is larger, like I said, than you would think. If you see just a picture of it flying, you don't really have anything necessarily to give you the scale of this thing. But I've seen pictures of a person standing next to him, and it does look like a fairly small but normal manned vehicle. I mean, mm-hmm. It looks like there could be a pilot in there if there were a cockpit. There
right.
just isn't.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
It's weird because the CIA was able to really develop a predator program. And when I say weird, I mean that you would think that would normally fall under the purview of the United States military.
Right. And the Department of Defense did spend some $3 billion in drone research in the 1990s. However, since the CIA, basically since the bombings of 2001.
Yeah.
The World Trade Center and or attacks, I suppose you would say, since then, the CIA kind of took over. You kind of used a loophole.
Yeah, what really was happening was that the military had run into kind of a, you know, they had consolidated a lot of departments, and so the whole drone program now fell under a subdepartment of a subdepartment of a department. And it was one of those things where it is really hard to get any kind of funding for the drone program. The CIA could sort of sidestep that, and because they're not a military organization, they could end up requesting under their budget their own drone program, and so that's exactly what they did.
And that's part of the reason why it started as a reconnaissance issue, and since 2001 developed into a targeted strike program.
Yeah, so these Predator drones can hover for 40 hours before needing to refuel. They were kind of the evolution of earlier drones developed called Amber and Gnat. These were drones that were used previously, but had their own limitations, including things like weather issues with, you know, inclement weather. So the Predator was meant to withstand that sort of stuff. It was built by a company called General Atomics, and it uses a SATCOM link-up. So that's why you can control these all the way out in Nevada, while the drones themselves are flying around perhaps in Afghanistan or Pakistan or something like that. They were first flown in June 1994 in the Balkans under Operation Nomad Vigil, and then in 1995 in Operation Deliberate Force. And in those initial phases, it was just surveillance, like we had said. But the Air Force and CIA both began to develop their Predator piloting programs. The Air Force's is called the 11th Reconnaissance Squadron at Indian Springs Auxiliary Airfield in Nevada, which later became known as Creech Air Force Base, and tends to concentrate on missions in places like Afghanistan. In 2001, the military began to test the Predator drone as a weapon, and by October 7th, 2001, armed Predator drones were deployed in the Middle East, and that was very much in response to the September 11th attacks in 2001. Prior to that, they were just being used as reconnaissance, but those attacks kind of spurred the development of weaponized drones and put them on the fast track. And on February 4th, 2002, we had the first use of a CIA-controlled Predator drone using a weapon. And what had happened was, a drone operator had identified a potential target. They saw a tall man in robes, and it seemed to fit the description of Osama bin Laden, which obviously was a top target of the CIA. And so believing that to be Osama bin Laden, the pilot of the drone,
they were
opened
authorized
up fire,
to open fire, right?
And they fired a Hellfire missile. And it was actually three civilians. None of them were identified as being connected to any enemy forces whatsoever.
They had been gathering scrap metal at the time.
Now, they had been gathering scrap metal that were from old pieces of missiles, but they were, from what I understand, trying to sell those in Pakistan for about 50 cents. So it turned out that these were appeared to be innocent victims, although the United States government continued to say that they felt that they got that firing on the targets were justified. They just didn't know who they were, which I thought was a weird way of putting it.
That seems like a poor justification to me personally. And that is kind of what was said by many people afterwards.
Right. And this is illustrating very clearly. And, you know, keep in mind, this is the first use of the CIA using a Predator drone as a weapon. And the very first use is misidentification.
A tragic mistake.
And that illustrated very much the criticism that a lot of people had. It's that on multiple fronts. One, in this case, they were in a zone that had been under contention in the past. So perhaps the war zone question we'll put aside for a moment. But the real question is that if you have a weapon where you are in no danger at all,
The operator of the weapon is in no danger.
Right. There's no risk to the operator whatsoever. Does that lower the bar to using the weapon? Because you don't have to worry about anything, you know, any kind of direct consequences as far as a life or death situation. Meaning that, are you more likely to fire a gun if it means that there is absolutely no way the other person's going to fire back? And that,
furthermore, are you not going to take time to assess the situation responsibly?
Right. If you think that you have a target, are you going to act, rapidly because you think that you have the opportunity to take the target out rather than to take the time you would, need to assess the situation? If your life was at risk, obviously you would be assessing the situation very carefully to try and determine your best chance of success and survival of that event. And maybe in that process, you might notice if someone is not who you thought they were, in which case you would abort the mission and no one would die. So these were some of the objections that were raised, saying that this is making it too easy to kill people. And then on top of that, if it's outside a war zone, because the CIA was essentially given carte blanche to go and go after what a lot of people have called the kill list, a list of people that the United States government had identified as top level threats. If the CIA were to use an unmanned aerial vehicle to take out one of those targets in a place that's not a war zone, so this is not someone who's a soldier fighting a war in the traditional sense, does that not amount to assassination? So how is that any different than, say, sending out somebody with a sniper rifle to take another person out in the middle of a city? They have no benefit of any sort of trial or formal charges. It's just a political assassination. In this case, instead of a sniper with a rifle, you're talking about a pilot using a Predator drone. And that in reality, that's not any different. So wouldn't that mean that this is, under international law, illegal?
And furthermore, isn't it something that shortly before the attacks of September 11th, the U.S. came down on Israel for using drones for assassinations?
Yeah. And so this is very tricky. We've got government officials on record as saying this is not something we should do. And then
immediately authorizing
it.
Certainly the fear of terrorism at that time and continually is an understandably serious issue.
It's a powerful motivator.
Absolutely.
It's a powerful motivator. And sometimes that means going to a course of action that perhaps in hindsight we would say this was not the right choice.
Right.
The American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, condemns these actions and have said outright that they are essentially assassinations, that people are being killed when they are not in war zones, and that's without charge or trial. And they've submitted several Freedom of Information Act requests to the government regarding missile strikes and various targets throughout the world. And they've cited that in many of these cases, civilians have died, children have died as a result of these strikes. And they also have kind of met with a lot of non-answers from the government. They await the responses. You know, they're going through the official government channels and not getting much response.
Right. In March of 2013, Pitch Interactive released a report. They had gotten their information from the New America Foundation, saying that the casualties from drones in Pakistan alone totaled some 3,105 people since 2004, and that of that, 175 deaths were children, 535 were adult civilians, over 2,000 were this gray area of other. They had been deemed a military age-appropriate men who had been termed military combatants, but whether or not they were actually involved in any nefarious military wrongdoing was kind of like, meh.
Yeah.
And that only 47, 1.5% of those deaths were high-profile targets. And there had been somewhat under 100 high-profile targets from what I understand. And so having 47 deaths from that list is huge.
Sure.
And however, oh my goodness gracious, that is just so many people.
Yeah, this is an incredibly, you know, emotionally charged topic, obviously, and should be. I mean, this is, again, why we say there should be debate about this and that there needs to be very close scrutiny over when it's appropriate or if it ever is appropriate to use this. I mean, obviously, anytime we're talking about warfare in any capacity, we're talking about the tragic loss of human life. That kind of comes hand in hand with warfare. The problem is that warfare itself has changed dramatically since the you know, early 20th century when we had two sides line up on trenches and shoot at each other. Now, identifying who your enemy is and where that your enemy happens to be is much more complicated. We don't necessarily have huge battalions of soldiers that we're having to aim at. It's gotten to be a very messy situation. And so we've tried to come up with some solutions to address that. The problem is that the solutions may not truly be addressing the issue and in fact could be causing far more harm than good. And that's where we have to sit there and really look at how we're using the technology, who is being affected. Are we causing more harm than good? And if so, then what can we do instead of that? Because right. Obviously that's a course of action. You cannot in any good conscience continue that and hope that there's going to be a positive outcome. How can there be a positive outcome if you're not hitting who you want to hit and the people you are hitting are completely innocent? You're really, there's...
Or if you've got such a high loss of innocent life connected to your targets.
Yeah. I mean, that's, how can you criticize another government or regime or however you want to define it for their behaviors if your own behaviors appear at least as,
right, if
not
if you
more,
consider it an acceptable loss of life to kill the entire family of right. someone who you're targeting.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously this is obviously, like we said, very tricky. It's not like we're trying to say that there is some easy solution that
absolutely
that
not.
We should
and,
switch to.
And these high profile targeted people were committing atrocities, absolutely.
Yeah,
and
right.
So
it's, you know, obviously by international law, the argument is that what should happen is that every effort should be made to apprehend the individuals, put them on trial, and then have them face their crimes in a court of law, as opposed to kind of striking out and trying to eliminate them, whether it's in a war capacity or otherwise. Whether or not that's correct also, I guess, is a matter of debate. It has to be answered by all the different countries involved. And it, like I said, this is pretty, pretty sticky stuff. It goes pretty far outside the realm of just talking about how drones work. But we really wanted to talk about this because it's one of those topics that has had a lot of conversation around it over the last year or so.
Absolutely. And I did want to say that in addition to those military uses, drones have also been used, for example, to detect bombs.
Sure.
Which is wonderful and terrific. And,
right.
you know, in the future, they could possibly be used to create wireless networks in disaster areas that will significantly improve, disaster relief.
Sure. Yeah. Again, just like any technology, we've said this a lot on various episodes of Tech Stuff. It's not the technology that's good or bad. It's how we put it to use. We have to be responsible users of technology, and that goes all the way from the individual in the case of a Parrot drone that has a camera attached to it, you know what I'm talking about, or whether we're talking about a military program or CIA program, that level of responsibility is something that we cannot ignore or take for granted. I really do believe that. And now I'm going to responsibly tie up the end of this podcast by letting you guys know that if you have anything you want to share with us, you have a topic that you think we should tackle, maybe you have your own thoughts about the way that drones are being used throughout the world, maybe you want a pizza, let us know. We probably can't get a pizza to you, but we're happy to listen and chat back with you. Send us a line over at techstuff@discovery.com or drop us a note on Facebook or Twitter. You can find our handle there at TechStuffHSW. And there's something else. I always forget. It's
Tumblr.
Oh, right. It's because I don't do that one.
We has a Tumblr.
That's
you,
true.
You did start it and then promptly forgot that it even existed.
Yes,
our Tumblr handle is also TechStuffHSW.
All right. So track us down and take us gently by the shoulder. Look us in the eye and tell us what it is you want us to cover next, because we genuinely want to know. And Lauren and I will talk to you again really soon. By the way, just do that virtually. We don't really want you coming up to us.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without finger sticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.